Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wharfairn conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later today, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If you should require assistance during today's conference, you may press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone to speak with an operator. Finally, as a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now, I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Diane Rue-Larange.
Thank you, Daniel. And hello, I am Diane Rue-Larange. Welcome. Thank you for joining the sixth in a series of teleconferences on Wharfairn safety. This is brought to you by iPro. We at iPro and the Medicare Prescription Drug Benefit Program are under contract with the CMS. We seek to improve the quality of healthcare and promote patient safety. We offer all our activities free of charge. This series on Wharfairn safety is an educational platform to promote the application of evidence-based practice. To this end, I'm pleased to have Dr. Jeffrey Kennicott with us today. This presentation is a departure from the previous presentations in that Dr. Kennicott addresses the what-if case of a patient being over-anticoagulated. What to do? He presents these guidelines that would avert further harm to the patient. Given the high likelihood of warfarin in causing bleeding events, it is well worth your attention and resources to institute a systems-wide review of your facility's policies and procedures. Dr. Jeffrey Kennicott is currently clinical pharmacy specialist in infectious disease at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany, New York. He also serves as adjunct faculty for Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences and a lecturer in advanced pharmacology at Sage College's Graduate School of Nursing. With his previous work in nursing care facilities, he brought a team focus in residential care, instituting comprehensive geriatric assessment and prescribing services. For those of you who participated, that is, listened in to our other programs, you know that at the end of this presentation, you will have an open mic for questions and answers. Please take notes for this purpose. And meanwhile, keep your phone on mute. I will also ask you to be kind and find the evaluation form and complete it. You can find the form either on the SurveyMonkey link or on the Joint Effort New York site. These links will be found on Jeffrey's last slide. Thank you again, Dr. Kennicott. I'm turning this over to you.
Okay, it's my pleasure to be here today. It's very nice to be doing a follow-up lecture, this one dealing more with, as Diane said, the patient that finds himself in a situation of being over-anticoagulated, presumably with warfarin is where our talk is going to talk most about. And as you know, in nursing homes, events like this do occur. Our elderly folks seem to be have a higher level of risk for problems with warfarin. And nursing homes, of course, have a responsibility to track adverse drug events with drugs and to identify adverse drug events and to analyze them for their own improvement purposes. Anticoagulants definitely fall into that box. So today's title is Reducing Warfarin-Related Adverse Drug Reactions Using Laboratory and Vitamin K Reports. Referring to slide number 3, as we all know, and I talked about this previously, warfarin is highly regulated in the long-term care environment. We have a lot of responsibility to both New York State, all state health departments, I imagine, and of course the Joint Commission if you're accredited as a long-term care facility. It is a medication considered, as I just said, a high-risk medication for adverse events, and requires really in the long-term care setting, especially a high acuity for prescribers paying attention, consultant pharmacists paying attention, as well as nursing and administrators in nursing homes paying attention, and hopefully be able to point you in some directions that'll help you accomplish that. in your various practices. So referring to slide 4, warfarin again is a vitamin K antagonist. And this slide looks simple. It is in a certain way, because what warfarin does is it impairs the conversion of precursor anticoagulant proteins to functional ones. If you impair vitamin K, which warfarin is, a vitamin K antagonist, you begin to shut down the production of functional clotting factors. In those types of patients, this is desirable, patients with AFib, patients with venous thrombosis. This therapy can be life-saving, but it has its risks. Over-anticoagulation patients, patients that are over-anticoagulated, of course, are at risk for bleeding. And if you remember from previous lectures and discussions and guidelines, hopefully you've had a chance to look at them, lots of things interfere with warfarin's relationship to that patient. Drug interactions, comorbidities such as congestive heart failure and infection, all sorts of things change the way a patient handles warfarin and also changes the way functional clotting factors are produced from the liver. Referring to slide 5, just a quick reminder that these clotting factors have their own biological half-lives. And I think the best way to sum it up, really, is that patients, you know, have a delayed reaction to warfarin. You're not immediately anticoagulated with the first dose. And as, just as a reminder, I'm sure many of you are very familiar with this. But anticoagulation is a process. As you shut down the production engine, so to speak, in the liver with warfarin, with daily doses of warfarin, the previously produced active clotting factors have to wear out, and these are their biological half-lives on slide 5. And this slide hopefully explains the delay in a warfarin-naive patient, in a patient whose INR would frankly be expected to be 1. And they're warfarin-naive, and that delay is at least 5 to 7 days in most patients. So let's kick it right off with slide number 6, our case. Our case is an elderly patient with an elevated PTINR. The lab calls the nursing station to report that AH, a 91-year-old nursing home resident, has an INR of 5.2. The reason for warfarin is atrial fibrillation. And warfarin is being dosed currently at 3 milligrams a day, a very normal or average dose for most elderly folks. As you know, elderly folks generally require less warfarin than some folks in the age brackets of 40, 50, 60 years of age. The target INR is noted in the chart. They have a warfarin monitoring flow sheet in this patient's chart, and that INR is 2.5. That's our goal. But an acceptable range is also noted for this patient, and that's a range of 1.7 to 3.4. But unfortunately, today's lab comes back and it's 5.2 from a routine monitoring. Well, the first thing we're worried about in turning to slide 7 to begin the discussion of this is, as a prescriber, as a pharmacist, or as a nurse, we are definitely instructed about the hemorrhagic complications associated with warfarin. The bleeding risk has been quantified. It's been looked at in different populations, and I just want to take a few slides this afternoon to shape this up and to take a look at it. So in published controlled warfarin studies, the risk of a major bleed is a little less than 1% per year of therapy. And the risk of an intracranial hemorrhage is about 2.2% per year. So those are relatively low risks for folks. And this is in published controlled, very tightly controlled patient populations, very specific studies where patients who are really probably at any form of a bleeding risk were basically not allowed to be in the study. So actually, bleeding risk is thought to be a little bit higher in the general population because, as you know, when we treat patients, we're not always as strict or as controlled as far as study entry criteria when the clinical studies are conducted for certain agents. I took the trouble in slide 8, if you will, to list exclusion criteria for clinical studies. Studies vary a little bit, but by and large, the exclusion criteria are many and actually encompass some fairly common items. Patients, of course, with active bleeding, active peptic ulcer disease, and also known anticoagulation defects. Skipping down a little bit, second bullet up from the bottom, daily use of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which is a common drug often seen. History of falls, 3 within the previous year or recurrent injurious falls. Any history of dementia or severe cognitive impairment. These are the relative and in the cases of clinical studies, the absolute contraindications to entrance in the study. So if you eliminate a lot of these patients, obviously you eliminate a lot of risks for bleeding. Let's see. How about on to slide 9? So slide 9 is a study that I selected because this patient population by Garcia was a population of patients that we would see in normal clinical practice. Garcia looked at over 6,000 patients and selected out 979 of them who presented with an elevated INR like our patient between 5 and 9. 22% of these patients were greater than 80 years of age, and they were basically from community-based sites. But nonetheless, there's a large cohort that's or a relatively good-sized cohort that's advanced age, much like our nursing home situation. So patients were identified with an INR between 5 and 9, 96% were less than 9. And the mean INR in this group was 6.5, okay? So I just want to, you know, get out some of the details. And interestingly, and I'm turning a little corner with the use of vitamin K here, because vitamin K is obviously the rescue or the agent used to reverse warfarin anticoagulation. Vitamin K was used in only 8.7% of the population here. So of those nearly 1,000 patients, only 8 to 9% of them received any vitamin K use whatsoever to reverse their anticoagulation. And the 30-day major bleeding that occurred in this population was 1%. And that's very comparable, to what you might expect. Many patients at high risk for bleeding, however, criteria, or what is major bleeding in this particular study and in most studies, is actually a fatal event, an intracranial hemorrhage, retroperitoneal bleeding. These were the common forms of major bleeding that were identified. Also, any bleeding that required hospitalization along with administration of 2 units of packed red blood cells. All other types of bleeding were minor, so nosebleeds, bruising, things of that are not considered in this group and are considered minor events. It's major bleeding that we're mostly concerned about. And this study shows, and we're going to develop this further, a very low incidence of vitamin K use. Slide 10. So an analysis of 6 other trials with more than 1,900 patients with atrial fib, much like our nursing home patient, major hemorrhage occurred more often in patients greater than 75 years of age. So 75 years of age is a stronger risk factor, and greater than that is a stronger risk factor for a higher risk of bleeding, okay, major hemorrhage. And what I want to say here is that this is our population, so we have to be sensitive, really, because of age being a significant risk factor for bleeding, of how we respond to a high INR event. Let's see, slide 11. Major determinants of warfarin-induced bleeding are also the intensity of the anticoagulant effect, in other words, INRs that are greater than 3. But I want to point out that intracranial hemorrhage is also more prevalent in patients who are 75 years of age. Okay, so bleeding events that include intracranial hemorrhage, a devastating and catastrophic adverse effect to an elevated INR, are more frequent in elderly people. Also, patients who have underlying characteristics such as a history of bleeding, diabetes, kidney disease, cancer, coronary artery disease, an ischemic stroke, all of those patients have specific comorbidities that increase the risk of bleeding associated with supertherapeutic INRs and with warfarin therapy. Also, patients early on in the course, within the first 90 days, seem to have a higher risk of bleeding. But also length of therapy in patients, obviously the longer you stay on warfarin, the longer you have a risk of bleeding. So concomitant drugs also interfere. Antiplatelet drugs, Tylenol, and anti-inflammatory agents such as non-steroidals all have the ability to affect platelet function and thus also contribute to a risk of bleeding. So in summary, major bleeding in a cohort of patients greater than 75 years of age is an event that varies somewhere in the area of 1.7% to as high as 10% in the clinical studies looking at these types of patients. Okay, so there are bleeding rates as high as 10% in certain studies, and these it's yet to be determined exactly where we are with this. Is it 2%? 3% or even as high as 10%. The studies vary quite a bit. In an outpatient study done by Kaiser Permanente, I took a look at outpatients saw a bleeding rate of 1.52 per 100 patient years. That's a fairly low event rate. And in the background, we have to remember that these types of patients have a high background rate for bleeding. So background rates of bleeding in these types of patients with these risk factors tends to be about 4%. So I hope that helps balance that up, and I want to kind of move on from the bleeding risk, getting more into, at this point, how to manage this and systems and where the pharmacist, the prescriber, and the nurse fits into the process at the nursing home. Slide 12. This slide is really a rehash of the previous one. I sort of apologize for that. This particular slide, my purpose was to show you that there is a risk prediction model. And if you look at the chart underneath, sum of risk factors, using the risk factors listed above, you can use and estimate a patient's bleeding risk based on those risk factors and look at basically patients who have a much higher risk of bleeding with 3 to 4 risk factors, somewhere in the area of 23% in 3 months of warfarin treatment. Going to slide 13. One of the things that we're going to develop is holding of doses, okay? So that first slide, or I think it was back up there somewhere around slide 3 or 4, where I said only about 9% of patients used a reversal agent, used vitamin K. Well, why only 9%? Because holding of doses, even in the elderly cohort, is a very appropriate way of managing warfarin and managing warfarin's supratherapeutic INR levels. So how long would it take, really, or as far as holding doses of warfarin for a patient to return to an INR of 2.0 or an INR of somewhat near their target or within their target range? Usually, in a large group of patients, it would be somewhere around 3 days, okay? It's 2 to 3 days. And if you notice the statistic, a return to INR of 4.0 occurred in 67% of patients after 48 hours, and a return to an INR of 2.0 occurred in 12% of patients after 48 hours. It's known that older patients have a slower return to a therapeutic INR. And what that means is basically usually add a day. But this particular study by Hylek included a lot of older patients, and I consider the study to be relatively indicative of what you might expect with older patients because there were a large group in that cohort. Also, patients who return more slowly have other features as far as their situation. Obviously, patients that start with a higher initial INR, maybe 7, 8, 9, those types of patients are often prudent if there's no active bleeding for just holding doses, no use of vitamin K required, but they return slower. They have a little further to go. Patients with decompensated CHF fit in this category, as well as patients with active cancer. So those folks return slower. Slower return to a therapeutic INR means they're another day longer, perhaps, at an increased risk for bleeding. And that's an important consideration in some cases. I think what you might be thinking is, well, how would I ever write a protocol when I have so many variables from which to really manage these types of patients? And that's a very good point. I think at this point I'd say knowing the difference between writing a guideline and having a protocol is an important thing. Protocols are checkboxes on a prescriber order sheet. Follow protocol, a very defined protocol. It's often very difficult to do managing warfarin in the individualized setting of the types of patients that we deal with, because they have so many comorbidities, including age and other risk factors for bleeding, that it's hard to protocolize these things. But it's easy to educate prescribers. Pharmacists can do this. Nurses and pharmacists can do this. You can have guidelines available that can be read to a prescriber over the telephone, helping them understand bleeding risk in this particular situation, having materials like this available. Slide 14. So back to our patient. She's still sitting there with her INR of 5.2, and we'll pick her up there now again. First, this list here on the right side of slide 14 is really directed, I think, mostly at the prescriber. But the analysis and the evaluation of the patient is multidisciplinary. A pharmacist has a role. A prescriber usually is the one that's going to make the order changes. And also, the nurse has a role. In this situation, a nurse, obviously, in most nursing homes, usually has a protocol for assessment of bleeding risk. And an INR out of the therapeutic range would cause you to assess that patient for bleeding. Some people would include in that protocol looking for changes in mental status, i.e. an intracranial hemorrhage, that type of thing, and including bruising and things like that. But a prescriber would kind of work through the list on the right. Questions to ask would be inaccuracy in the INR testing. In other words, was the tube filled correctly? Is it the right patient? Questions about their recent vitamin K intake, recent new concomitant drugs that were put in place. Hence, you might be thinking about antibiotic-drug interactions. Is that an answer for this type of thing? But one should do a quick assessment and look at the various things that would be put a patient into an elevated INR. And obviously, based on the results of that assessment, that would drive what we're going to do about it. Okay. So looking at slide 15, this patient, the nurse calls the physician, and the physician gives the nurse an order that says, hold warfarin, give vitamin K, 10 milligrams sub-Q, and check INR tomorrow. So remember that the patient's order was that their target range was 2.7 to 3.4, and their goal INR is 2.5. And the prescriber is responding with hold warfarin, that's very appropriate, and give vitamin K subcutaneously at 10 milligrams now, check INR tomorrow. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Now, slide 16 is a guideline for correction of supertherapeutic anticoagulation caused by warfarin, very nicely put together by the IPRO group. And you'll notice that our patient is in the second box down. She's been assessed. She has no significant active bleeding, and her INR is between 5 and 8.9, and the recommendation for warfarin is omit 1 to 2 doses, decrease dose. If bleeding risk is high, omit 1 dose and give vitamin K. Slide over to the furthest box on the right, and here's the vitamin K recommendation specifically. The dose is to be 1 to 2.5 milligrams by mouth. If rapid reversal is required because of urgent surgery, not the case, other doses can be used. If an INR is still high after a day, give an additional 1 to 2 milligrams by mouth. So our patient is set up to get 10 milligrams, and that dose is to be given subcutaneously. And let's talk about that on slide 17. So our recommendation was to give 1 to 2 milligrams by mouth, not subcutaneously. So what's the problem with that? Actually, oral absorption tends to be more reliable and less problematic than subcutaneous administration. Obviously, you give subcutaneous to a patient that can't take oral, but I assume they could if they were taking oral warfarin. Subcutaneous also carries with it a bleeding risk. When you inject in a medication for a patient with an elevated INR, you're going to see a higher rate of incidence of bleeding. So a large hematoma can result at the site of administration for the subcutaneous. So because of reliable PO absorption, which takes away the necessity of giving the drug subcutaneously, oral is recommended. And that's recommended through guideline after guideline, both by the Geriatric Society. Wherever you look, you'll see that oral is recommended when it can be used in situations where bleeding is not occurring. Now, what about the dose, item number two? Our patient's set to receive 10 milligrams, not the 1 to 2.5 milligrams PO. Now, first of all, there's an omission of a dose of warfarin. That was done, and the warfarin's held, but this large dose of vitamin K. The problem with large doses of vitamin K is that, well, let's look at the pro side of it before the problem. The pro side of it is you can expect to have a more rapid reversal of vitamin K. Probably within 24 to 48 hours, you're going to have an INR with 10 milligrams of 1.0. Okay, so their INR is going to return at that point to normal. And that's a problem for a patient that needs to be anticoagulated, obviously. So that swings them back into the prothrombotic risk. If they have an active VTE, that's a very high risk for thrombosis. And obviously, as you all know, thrombosis leads to situations like pulmonary emboli. Pulmonary emboli carry a 40 to 50% morbidity in this population with one event. So thromboemboli as a result of vitamin K reversal is a real problem, and 10 milligrams will often get you there. That's why the guidelines say 1 to 2.5 milligrams. 1 to 2.5 is a slower return, and hopefully a return to an INR that will settle in the therapeutic range. We don't need an INR of 1.0. We're not bleeding. We need an INR at this patient's target of 2.5. And as I said earlier, holding doses for 2 to 3 days in this patient population is a very acceptable way of also getting to an INR of 2.0. You would recheck INR probably daily to make sure that you're getting there, but you would avoid putting that patient in a prothrombotic situation, which carries a very significant risk for these folks. Let's use slide 18. So does warfarin resistance increase the risk for ADR? What do I mean, warfarin resistance? Well, warfarin resistance is the term or the phrase that we use for patients who have received a lot of vitamin K. So these are patients who are chronically anticoagulated with warfarin. We give vitamin K, and we create a syndrome of warfarin resistance. Very few people have really studied or quantified warfarin resistance in different populations, but it's known that what we're referring to is a return to an INR of 1.0. Now, that would be nice if we return to an INR of 1.0 for a day, and we could restart warfarin right away, and we would return, of course, to having a therapeutic INR within 24 to 48 hours with warfarin. But that's not how it works, because basically when you bring a patient back with vitamin K and replete vitamin K stores in the liver, we set up a scenario where we're probably going to be basically calling this patient warfarin naive at this point. And as you know, when you initiate warfarin in patients, it can take 2 to 3 weeks before we get back to steady state warfarin anticoagulation. So it's just like basically starting all over again. And was it really necessary in a patient that's not bleeding? Was it really necessary in a patient that had, for whatever reason, a INR of 5.2? The bleeding risk that's associated with an INR of 0.52 is there, but this patient wasn't bleeding. You're in a long-term care facility with close evaluation and monitoring of the patient. So that some people would say that you could look at the administration in this case of 10 milligrams of vitamin K as a prescribing error. Okay? Some people would also say that by prescribing 10 milligrams of vitamin K, you've put the patient at risk for adverse drug events associated like thromboemboli. So that's what we're getting at, is we want to look at vitamin K use in nursing homes. We want to have you look at the vitamin K, the type of vitamin K that you're using. How many events have you had like this? What exactly are you doing as far as responding to supratherapeutic INRs? So slide 19 gets at that a little bit. First, I think it's important for you to look at the vitamin K that's in your emergency kits. Now, emergency kits are controlled, and their contents are controlled by the Department of Health in New York State. And obviously, most of you realize that 5 oral medications are allowed per kit, but the number of kits is flexible in the nursing facility. A nursing facility could have any number of kits, theoretically. So if you had, for instance, 5 kits, you could have 5 oral medications in the kit. And to me, that wouldn't be hard to have at least one of those oral medications be vitamin K. Okay? Now, I asked one of our pharmacy providers that provides to a lot of nursing homes up here in the Albany area to tell me what is in their vitamin K, what type of vitamin K is in their e-kits. And 53% of those facilities have an oral form of vitamin K as 5 milligrams in the kit, and 82% of facilities have some form of parenteral vitamin K. So most have parenteral vitamin K, the vast majority, and about half of them have some oral vitamin K. None of them have vitamin K, at least by his initial analysis at this particular pharmacy, vitamin K in an oral form of 1/2 a tablet, which is 1/2 of a 5 milligram tablet is 2.5. That 2.5 milligram dose brings us to be able to comply with the guideline. Another way to comply with the guideline is to use a parenteral ampule and measure a dose of vitamin K and administer it orally. That's perfectly acceptable. I kind of like the idea of having a tablet form available as a 2.5, but if a prescriber wanted to prescribe 1 milligram, they would use a 1/10 of a 10 milligram ampule, and that could be administered orally. That's routinely done in many settings. It's been written about in the literature. It's absorbed very well. It's not a problem. But what if our prescriber is a prescriber who usually asks for vitamin K 10 milligrams sub-Q? Well, this particular pharmacy up here in Albany also gave me some data about prescribing. And they're prescribing or dispensings, and I don't know the denominator, but in the year 2010, they dispensed vitamin K out of e-kits about 1,400 times, okay? And that's, based on the denominator, I'm not sure, but that seems like an awful lot of dispensings. About 60% of those dispensings were the subcutaneous type. Assuming that those were given subcutaneous, we have quite a bit of improvement to look at in many of our facilities here in the that are being served by this particular pharmacy. Also, the pharmacy knew that dispensings for 5 milligram tablets had totaled about the other 50%. So, again, I refer back to that need to target 2.5 milligrams. I think it's a lot easier to have those tablets pre-split and to talk to your provider about having that type of thing in your e-kit. But, again, we have a prescriber asking for 10 milligrams of subcutaneous. And how are we gonna deal with that? Well, I think education is probably the best thing to do, to educate the medical director, to educate the medical staff and the nursing staff. Pharmacists can have a very strong role in this. They can reset the contents of the emergency kit. That's their purview. Pharmacists also look at Utilization of rescue medications. Part of their drill could be to analyze and take a look at when the e-kit was opened, who received the medications, and specifically looking at vitamin K, what was the outcome or result of the situation. And to basically QI the situation as far as, was it appropriate? Was it the right thing to do? We have plenty of guidelines, both chest and in various places for managing this. Quality improvement analysis and quality improvement surveys can use and take some of the tenets from the guideline and look at your utilization, and then ask the medical director to receive a report on that and try to educate them as to what probably should be done. You can also draft an internal policy for vitamin K and warfarin prescribing. Okay, so all of this is possible and not that hard to do. I think what it really takes is a pharmacist, a medical director, and a director of nursing who need or want to do something about this for their patients. So slide 20. Remember, a template, again, is having a systematic approach, okay, a multidisciplinary approach. It would be hard to do any of this analysis without the use of an anticoagulation flow sheet, okay? This kind of gets your patients organized. You know what you were doing, you know why you did it, and you know why you're using warfarin, and you know what your target goals are. And all of this type of information becomes very useful in an assessment in the QI setting. Moving on to slide 21, that systematic approach could also include having daily drug use notification reports. Now, what do I mean by that? I referred to it in my first presentation as far as interacting medications that for patients that are on warfarin. But also, any dispensing of vitamin K could be notified. And this would be within 24 hours. That would be very useful for a manager or for a supervisor of a particular unit to know. Obviously, this type of thing probably could be managed by putting it on a report. Also, laboratories can be encouraged and can develop a system for notification of INR on a daily basis in a report by email or whatever mechanism you choose to use by fax of any patients who had an INR greater than, let's say, 4.0, or let's just say an INR less than 1.7. Now, I threw in the less than, too, because of the prothrombotic risk, the risk of emboli, and all the consequences that occur by having these types of patients poorly anticoagulated. This type of drug use notification report can be looked at by a lot of people. It's multidisciplinary. It could be a nurse, a nurse manager. It could be a prescriber when they walk into the facility for determining who they want to take a look at that day. Same with a consultant pharmacist. A consultant pharmacist off-site can be provided a report, and a phone call to the facility to find out what's going on is not out of the realm of possible as far as what pharmacists can do with action plans and follow-up. It would be nice if everybody was on the same page with a protocol or a guideline or the various tools that are associated with managing dosing of warfarin, use of vitamin K. Slide 23. So our patient, the nurse that's assessed correctly, there's no bleeding, she calls the doctor, and our doctor insists that he gives the vitamin K subcutaneous check INR tomorrow, place patient on clinic list for tomorrow. Now, as I said earlier, is this a medication error? Is the prescriber, basically to look at the definition of a medication error? A medication error is any preventable event that can cause or lead to inappropriate medication use or patient harm while the medication is in control of that professional. And for instance, these type of events are often related to professional practice knowledge deficits. They're related to communication, often prescribing, administration. All of these things could encompass the notification of an error. So is vitamin K being used inappropriately? That's very much the responsibility of the consultant pharmacist and the medical director and the director of nursing home at the the director of nursing at the home, to determine how they want to define the use of vitamin K in the context of medication error. Now, why do I keep harping this? Because every home should have a medication error analysis process. So even if you don't get involved with a lot of in-depth management for a few patients on warfarin, perhaps you just want to make sure that you look at this in the context of your medication error committee, your P&T, your pharmacy and therapeutics committee. This should be analysis of medication events, analysis of prescribing situations. It can be a part, if you want to call it an error, of analysis in those particular committee settings. Slide 23. Same type of thing. Your lab system needs to define what type of INR they will make a phone call on and those daily reports. Your pharmacy system can be told, I want to know about any prescription for any vitamin K at a certain dosage level. Maybe you don't want to know about vitamin K on a daily report prescribed less than 2.5 milligrams or less per day. Maybe you're happy with that. So I leave these issues blank. Slide 24, please. So going back into Quality Improvement Committee again, Quality Improvement Committees are the universal leverage tool, okay? And you can set quality indicators, the percent of supertherapeutic INRs managed per protocol, insert guideline, compliance with the use of vitamin K order forms or vitamin K protocols or guidelines. You're getting the idea. Medication error analysis fits under quality indicators and improvement committee, as well as adverse drug reaction analysis fits there. Medication errors and adverse drug reactions must be incorporated into the culture of a nursing home, in my opinion. And they directly fall under the responsibility of that consultant clinical pharmacist. So an adverse drug event is defined as any injury resulting from the use of a drug. So any injury, okay? And it would be unfortunate if a patient suffered a thromboemboli from overcorrection of their situation associated with a high dose of vitamin K, but it does fit the model and the definition. Let's go to slide number 25. This is a nice paper that thankfully Diane actually pointed out to me by Lederer and colleagues, and this particular paper talked about QI and a methodology using a trigger of INR or vitamin K. And I'd like you to consider taking a look at this. The process was that they looked at it. They looked at it in a committee. They had a level of education that occurred, and they reviewed these things and they paid attention to it. It very much fits the type of model that I would like to urge you to adopt in your long-term care setting. This was in a primary care setting. I believe it was an insurance organization that was managing a large number of patients on an outpatient basis. But they looked at the lab system reported any INR greater than 3.0, and the pharmacy system reported any vitamin K dispensing. Then a group of people went back and looked at the charts, assessed the situation, determined what type of education, whether it was prescriber-specific. In my opinion, all prescribers aren't doing the same thing. Often you'll find a situation where a specific prescriber is someone who has a practice pattern that needs to be addressed more so than other prescribers. This type of information comes forward when you have an introspection and analysis and a process where you take a look at these things. Now, moving on to slide 26, what they did under the results column is in outpatient data, they showed a reduction of 53% reduction in anticoagulation events over a two-year period. This included many forms of education and staff training as far as and order sheets using this type of process. And the inpatient data, which was in a number of hospitals, was a 45% reduction in anticoagulation events. Those are rather robust improvements in patient care. So I see now that we're we're at 3:45, or pretty close to the last 15 minutes of our program. So in review, what I'd like to point out to you on slides 27 and slide 28 are that there are a lot of resources available to you to learn and to teach yourselves the details and what you need to do as far as managing anticoagulation, reversal of anticoagulation with vitamin K, and especially for the at-risk patients in the nursing homes. I'd like to say that we've spent a lot of time trying to tailor this presentation to nursing home patients specifically, and you can see on the IPRO website some very good materials as far as specific to long-term care and long-term care situations. For the consultant pharmacist at the facility, it's the consultant pharmacist's responsibility to take and be aware of medication prescribing patterns, adverse experiences that result from use of medications, and to bring those types of experiences and analysis forward to the medical director and the director of nursing. I think all of us as clinicians need to have a heightened awareness of the trouble that we can get into with warfarin resistance when we use too much vitamin K. I've seen situations personally where it doesn't always connect with the prescriber, the nurse, and the people taking care of the patient that the patient, after receipt of a large dose of vitamin K, is actually considered to be warfarin resistant and warfarin naive. What I've noticed is they expect the patient to return to a therapeutic INR within a day or two because they were always on warfarin and their dose was always 3 milligrams or 4 milligrams. And it is very hard to return that patient back to an INR in any less than 7 days, an INR in the therapeutic range. And it's unexpected. It's a situation where it sometimes leads to overly aggressive redosing of warfarin. So what you find is people shaking their heads saying, oh, it must have been a drug interaction, it must have been something, it must have been this or that. And the next thing you know, a patient that had a steady state diet of 3 milligrams of warfarin a day, now trying to get them back is in a situation where they're receiving 5, 6, 8 milligrams of warfarin a day. They're resistant, their INR is staying down low. We dose them and dose them until, boom, we end up over anticoagulating, and you kind of go through this seesaw trying to get back to steady state. It can take weeks. So there's a lot of room here, especially in light of the information from our Albany provider, using real local data. But this particular provider provides to a lot of nursing homes, okay, many, many nursing homes. And when you look at the fact that they use a lot of subcutaneous, parenteral, vitamin K, that points to a problem. In almost all cases, it could be oral. And I would just like to point out, again, that e-kits need to be looked at, and many things need to actually be addressed, but they're not complicated things. You take it in a stepwise process, and you do something like Lederer and colleagues, and before you know it, within a short period of time with education, analysis, and some attention to detail as far as protocols and guidelines, you can get to having a safer management of anticoagulation, which is really the goal for this whole program associated with IPRO and their initiative. So with that, I will finish my presentation. I'm looking forward to any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kennicott. Danielle, are you there to open up the questions and answers?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you wish to ask a question, please press the star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question is later answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue at any time, you may press the pound key to do so. Once again, to ask a question, please press star, then one. At this time, I see no questions in the queue.
Well, if there are no questions, one thing I would like to say is that Diane Rue Larange is a quality improvement specialist with IPRO. She is willing to talk to you further in more detail about how to set this type of quality improvement process and to put this quality improvement process in motion. She's already spoken with a number of nursing homes and has received a very favorable and very warm welcome from several facilities who want to get into this. And I think that's probably the next step. A lecture or a talk like this is an introduction. It paints a picture. It gets an idea. But follow-through is where the real rubber meets the road. And I'd be happy to talk about follow-through or putting together a program with any of you. So if you have questions, please feel free.
Our first question comes from the line of Ravinder Amin.
Well, I want to thank you for this very informative 1 hour. My question is, should there routinely be in the e-kits parenteral vitamin K, how often it is actually might be considered appropriate use of it, and whether it should go with maybe a little cautionary little note or little tag? Because I see the numbers are pretty stark. 82% of the facilities had parenteral vitamin K. 50% had 5 milligram of vitamin K tablets, and none had half a tablet of 5 milligram, which from your talk I gather is something that might need to be used most frequently.
I found myself thinking I might get asked this question. So let's just take it apart a little bit. Who determines what's in the e-kit? Well, the medical director, the director of nursing, and the pharmacist do that. So it would be hard to broad brush all medical facilities, but I think a facility ought to take a look at it. And if you go back to slide 16, the recommendations basically do not really include IV administration in a nursing home of vitamin K, and that's pretty much what parenteral is identified for. But remember, you'll have a patient that can't swallow, and you really need to give vitamin K. So if you want to educate and say, listen, we prefer PO, we've got lots of PO, PO is ready to go here, I've got doses of split tablet already made, 2.5. I like your idea of pushing PO, but potentially still having some subcutaneous available based on the three of you putting that together.
Thank you. We have another question.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. Pardon me, we do have another question from Ravindra.
Say your name.
Hi, this is Dr. Patel. Just had a question about something that you mentioned probably already. This is regarding the sub-Q vitamin K in the e-kits. If I remember correctly, what you mentioned was that if a patient needs like a 1 milligram dose, then it would be okay to give a 1 milligram appropriate dose measured from a sub-Q vial and give it orally. Is that what you meant?
That is what I meant. And it's done. There are two forms, there's probably more, but I'm aware of two forms of subcutaneous vitamin K that come in ampules or vials, if you will. There's one that is a cylinder that contains 0.5 milligrams, and there is another that contains 10 milligrams. Both of those are potentially available from your pharmacy supplier. The 10 milligrams is the most common size ampule. Most people use that. Most people are most familiar with that. And you can measure a 1 milligram dose and administer it as an oral liquid, even though it was marketed and intended to be used as for parenteral use.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you have another question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. At this time, I see no further questions in the queue.
Okay, so we have concluded, and thank you again, Dr. Kennicott, for this wonderful teleconference, and I'll be following up with anyone that wants to communicate with me, and I will be very interested in looking at the evaluations, because that's how we get credit for this. It's all free. We offer everything for free. Thank you again, and good day all.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude today's program, and you may now disconnect. Have a nice day.